You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 11th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, worse than Wisconsin. Rich Yselson on the imminent vote in the Michigan State House to make Michigan a right-to-work state could be signed as early as this afternoon. There are 15,000 people apparently surrounding in the State House in Lansing, Michigan as we speak. We'll talk about the implications of Michigan becoming a right-to-work-for-less state with Rich. Also on the program today, Nicholas Kristof pays a visit to the Appalachians and finds, of course, that Social Security insurance, bad thing. So many kids with disabilities obviously faking it. These people need to be punished in a good way. Tough love, folks. Antonin Scalia, still a major D-bag, apparently. The war on Christmas rages. And in Texas, lawmakers realize the folly of destroying funding for Planned Parenthood and providing some type of assistance to women to do some family planning. Like I said, right now in Michigan, there is a big day of action. At least 15,000 people, by all accounts, have gathered outside of the State House. I think they're taking the vote now in the Michigan House. I'm not sure what happens if the if it went to from the House to the Senate back to the House, and this is some type of conference bill. I'm not quite sure, but and I can't quite figure it out, to be honest with you. All I know is that we've got 15,000 people outside of the State House in Lansing. We will talk to Rich Yselson, who's written a piece in the American Prospect. This is not Wisconsin. It's worse. Want to just give you just a little bit of feedback on the we apparently have a lot of listeners who are Credo users of Credo Mobile. And tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking to Becky Bond from Credo and also Ken Burns on his latest documentary that he co-directed. You should know, just to put this in context, why are we seeing this happen in Michigan now during the lame duck session? In December of 2012, the makeup of the House, the Michigan House, 64 Republicans, 46 Democrats. In 3 weeks, the makeup of the House will be 59 Republicans and 51 Democrats. In other words, they won't have a supermajority. The number of lame duck House Republicans who voted for right to work, 13. Those 13 Republicans will be replaced by 7 Republicans and 6 Democrats. The number of lame duck House Democrats who voted against right to work, 13. Those will be replaced by 1 Republican and 12 Democrats. The number of Republicans who voted against right to work last week, 6. The number of those 6 Republicans who will be in the House in January of 2013, 6. Right to work vote on 12-6-2012 passed by 58 to 52. The likely right to the vote on right to work with new legislature in 2013 will fail 57 to 53 projected. But of course, by that point, it may be too late. My understanding of the nature of this bill is that it cannot be overturned by a referendum. So it would require Democrats taking over the Michigan House by about a 10-seat swing. You should know that this is also a function, again, of what happened in 2010 in local races in particular, but not necessarily statewide races, but races for state, for Senate, state Senate and state House seats. And this is all part, in many respects, of the redistricting. The next wave, and we're going to talk sometime in the next week or two, that we're going to see is an attempt by Republicans in these state houses, for instance, Michigan, for instance, perhaps Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, maybe in Ohio, to use the advantage that they have created for themselves by gerrymandering and creating very safe Republican congressional districts. For instance, in Pennsylvania, President Obama wins by half a dozen points or so, little more, 7. However, the Pennsylvania delegation to the House, to Congress, is, I think it's 13-5, Republicans to Democrats. This is because of redistricting. What the next thing we will see for Republicans in their attempt to win national elections will be to change the laws in these states to have the electoral vote not represent the popular vote in that state. In other words, Pennsylvania, President Obama wins by 6 or 7 points, so he gets all the electoral votes, but to shift it to be a function of the congressional districts. So in other words, Pennsylvania could see a situation where a significant majority of people vote for the Democratic presidential nominee. However, because of their gerrymandering, they have created a situation where more congressional districts are Republican, and therefore the state would go to the Republican nominee. Sort of a audacious plan, I guess you could say, but this is in the works. This is all part of that fallout from 2010. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Richie Selson. This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering a free audiobook. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report and get a free audiobook for Majority Report listeners. Why not pick up People's History of the United States, 1492 to present, by Howard Zinn. He talks about unions and the important power for unions in this country, obviously, and before that. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Now it's free. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Rich Yselson. He is a New York City, New York-based writer and has been working in the labor movement, providing strategy for the past 20 years. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. I hate to start this way, but I've got to make three corrections.
Okay.
I'm a D.C.-based writer.
Oh, sorry.
I have worked in the labor movement for 20 years. I no longer do. I left the labor movement at the beginning of this year. And my name is pronounced Yeselson,
but nobody gets
that right. So
I got the rich part right.
You got the Rich, you're beautiful, man. You're a pro.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'm going to try and do better right now. I've already started a hole. I haven't been talking to you for a minute.
I'm sorry. It's all that self-esteem stuff I got from my therapist. I just couldn't let you go.
Believe me, I understand. it's not something that I've not experienced. I've been married now for 8 years, and I've made three mistakes before I get in the door after work. All right, so let's. Your piece in The American Prospect, as we speak, I've mentioned that there's about 15,000 people protesting outside of the State House in Lansing, Michigan, for a vote that seems to be more or less a foregone conclusion. It's not clear whether or not Governor Snyder will actually sign this, but he's given all indications that he will. Let's start with the premise of your piece. Let's start with what is a so-called right-to-work state?
Okay. Right-to-work as a state-by-state concept came into effect via the passage of the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which is probably one of the five or six most important domestic policy pieces of legislation of the 20th century, right behind Medicare and Social Security and Obamacare and maybe a few others. Basically, what Right to Work did, Section 14B of the bill, is to permit states to allow workers not to join a union as a condition of employment. But not only that, not only not to join the union, but also not to pay the union what's called an agency fee, which compensates the union for representing the worker, because the worker will still gain from the benefits of a union-negotiated collective bargaining agreement, even if they're not in the union.
Right, and we're not talking about tangential benefits that because one union shop raises the wages for workers there, that other non-union shops will feel an upward pressure on wages. But literally, those people who are working alongside union members who are paying dues, the negotiations and the concessions that the unions get from management are benefits that everyone shares in.
Correct. I mean, it's a direct benefit. Basically, the man or woman next to you is paying union dues and getting a service for that. And you're not paying union dues, but you're getting the same services, whether it's increased safety and health regulations, which might prevent you from losing a limb, or increased wages, increased health care benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Before 1947, the entire country, based upon the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, had what's called closed shop, where basically you joined the union as a condition of employment, just as you, if your employer hires you for a first shift that starts 8 to 4, as a condition of employment, you have to show up at 8 o'clock, not at noon or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Same thing. But that was made a state-by-state prerogative after the Taft-Hartley Act of 47.
And not to put too fine a point on it, you've just sort of outlined an important dynamic there, because we are sold this notion of the so-called right to work laws as being, you know, enhancing worker freedom, but it only comes at the expense of workers in general, as opposed to, you know, the idea of, well, let's expand worker freedom to where they can set their own hours. Just wade into this a little bit, because I think this is very important for people to understand, because I think it's one of the biggest misconceptions and the most sort of arbitrary arguments of the libertarian ilk of the conservative mind, if you will.
Right. This is essentially a crock, and it's a crock that's been probably mixed metaphors, hidden behind a very high-minded argument about economic freedom that libertarians make. You'll find this on the National Right to Work Foundation, which is dedicated to this issue and actually provides a lot of very useful, objective, factual information about court decisions and about the rights that workers do have, depending on what state they're in, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, the claim is that, well, this takes away a worker's freedom because, you know, you're Joe or Josephine worker. You show up to work, and then suddenly this union official's in your face saying, "Hey, you got to join the union." Well, right. There's all kinds of things that you have to do at work. That's why all of us, every employee in the country, gets some sort of like worker employer handbook, which explains to them what their employer wants from them and what they expect from them and the things they can do and the things they can't do. Employers are not allowed to discriminate based on the essence of who you are, meaning whether you are of a race they don't like or a gender they don't like. But they are allowed. It's the basic of pretty much Anglo-American law going back a long way to set the terms and conditions of their employment. This is just another term and condition of employment. The difference is it's an agreement that's been made between a union and the employer to set that term and condition. It's not exclusively a term and condition set by the employer itself.
And that's
the fear that these libertarians have, that the union will gain more power.
And the next step of that argument is, of course, well, of course, the management can set certain conditions because they're the ones who are paying the workers. But, you know, the workers are getting benefit from the context of unions negotiating. So the net is obviously greater.
Exactly. And what right to work does, which in fact is the difference between a right to work state and a non-right to work state, is, you know, it doesn't even permit the worker to say, you know, I don't like the union's politics. You know, they're always supporting Democrats or whatever. You know, I'm not going to support that. But okay, I get it. I have to pay some fee to compensate the union for representing me and gaining me benefits via collective bargaining agreement. Right to work, as it will be played out in Michigan if this is finally implemented, and in the other 23 states where it is, says you don't pay the union anything, but the union still represents you. So, yeah, right. It is what's called the free rider problem.
Right. And so it's not, I mean, people should be clear here that this is not just simply saying you don't have to join the union. It means that you don't even have to pay a lesser fee in terms of compensating the union for the work they're doing on your behalf, in which you are gladly accepting. I mean, you know, you're not going to see a worker say, now that this is a right to work, I don't have to pay that fee. I'm not going to take the benefits that the union has negotiated on my behalf. I'm going to take 10-15% less in pay. I'm going to have a crappier pension or no pension. I'm going to work on the most dangerous machines that exist on the floor that aren't inspected on a regular basis, et cetera, et cetera. If this was going to be, if we were really going to play by those rules, you would have to see those workers give back those concessions.
Exactly. And that's in fact, in Michigan, at this moment, although that may change by the end of the day, and in the other non-right to work states, in fact, you already have that right. You simply have to pay again what's called this agency fee, which will be less by definition than what you would pay in union dues, because you're not also paying what would go into sustaining the union's political program or a community outreach program or anything else that the union does with its revenue base and its budget. You're only paying for your collective bargaining benefits, in effect.
And so and we know there has been, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to measure, particularly at a time when we have such a low rate of unionization in amongst the private workers in this country.
Right. 6.9%, which is the lowest it's been since around 1900. So it's pretty stunning.
Right. And
it's
not
the lowest in the Western world. It's the lowest in the advanced world. The French have a pretty low rate also, but it's important to know that even though the French have a low rate, the unions do negotiate collective bargaining agreements for almost 90% of French workers anyway. So, they're covered, and the unions still have a lot of power from that, but not here in the United States.
And we also know from the limited data that's out there that right-to-work states tend to have lower wages. They also tend to have more worker injuries and worker deaths because there is less protection for them. And so with all of that, why is what's happening in Michigan worse than what happened in Wisconsin?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One is that it covers the entire workforce. At this point in time in the United States, public sector workers are, as we were just implying, much more potent a force and much larger a force than private sector workers. There are about 35% of public sector workers are under union contract. And that's who was covered in Wisconsin. There was no effort to make Wisconsin a right-to-work state for private sector workers. And private sector workers, even in their currently atrophied condition as a potent labor union force, are the thing which drives economic changes for the workplace as a whole. When the UAW was at its peak in the 50s and 60s, it set like contract standards, wage and benefit standards in the United Steelworkers for all kinds of non-union employers. I mean, that helped build the American middle class in those decades. So to target directly private sector workers beyond the public sector efforts in, say, Wisconsin or Ohio is a dramatically different thing, and it is especially a dramatically different thing in the birthplace of the United Auto Workers, which really, really was the most important, powerful, and as Howard Morrison said in the American Prospect the other day, the best American union of the 20th century. So there's a very evocative kind of symbolic power to this possibly changing in Michigan as well.
Just give us a little history of the UAW's role, both in terms of empowering workers across the country, but also, and I think your piece points this out, the UAW also played a very strong role in social change in this country.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the first issue of empowering workers, I mean, the UAW followed the growth of what was called by some the Fordist economy, as in Ford Motor Company, but it also meant all the other great automobile companies. The manufacturing a spearhead of the entire U.S. economy. As those companies grew, workers felt empowered, and through very bloody, brutal, tough, militant action, as militant and tough as, again, any in the advanced Western world, they organized those companies in the mid-30s. When they organized those companies, that organization, again, also spread to steel, to rubber, to electric companies, to the entire manufacturing base, and produced that great economic change that I just alluded to earlier. But the UAW was more than just like a me-first labor union. It saw itself, especially through the eyes of its really remarkable president, Walter Reuther, as an institution to advance social justice in the United States more generally. Reuther was militantly anti-racist, fought racism in his own union, was a strong supporter of the civil rights movement at a time when other unions, frankly, were not. Worked directly and closely with Dr. King, stood behind him. You can see in the grainy photos and video of Dr. King giving his "I Have a Dream" speech in August 1963 in Washington. You can see Reuther behind him. Reuther also, underscored and helped even the development of Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s, like the core organization of the New Left. I mean, the Port Huron Statement, the founding document of that group, was written at a UAW-owned campground in Michigan, and that wasn't just a coincidence. That wasn't just they're renting out the campground. That was like going to a progressive group by the nation SES forces who would support them. Reuther, toward the end of his life, he died in 1970, also finally came out against the Vietnam War, which was also a very important break within the labor movement and within the broad American liberal left too. He hesitated to do that, as did Dr. King, because they both worked closely with Lyndon Johnson and wanted to maintain a good working relationship with him. But he did that as well. He even spoke out very early, like 69 maybe early 70 before he died, about environmentalism, which is something that you didn't hear in manufacturing groups, unions, or employers talk about much then. So it's just an incredibly important organization, not just in the history of the American labor movement, in the history of 20th century America.
You know, it's especially interesting to me because I wasn't really aware of Reuther's role and the UAW's role in that aspect of it, because one of the things that people have been writing about over the past couple of years is the cleave that developed between unions and the social liberal left around that time in the early 70s, which in some ways created a sort of a cycle of weakening the union support and strength in the Democratic Party, and then the Democrats not supporting unions. And it's you know, this idea that in many respects that was the beginning of the end of union strength, because unions became alienated from the social left, I guess, in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. You had essentially a split between, on one hand, there's no other way to say it, the white working class and especially its institutions, unions. And this is at a time when unions had 30% density in the workforce in the private sector, as opposed to, as I said, like 7% now. So it really mattered what there was a real political, economic, and social weight to what unions thought. And like emerging new progressive formations of the 60s and early 70s, feminism, the gay rights movement, to some extent the African American movement and the civil rights movement. But within that sort of broadly labor anxiety, I think, because a lot of this is a kind of social cultural anxiety toward these emerging groups that a lot of Americans share, and of course we know to this day a lot of Americans share, there was a split within labor. There were more progressive unions that were sympathetic to these groups. Part of it had to do with, like, their own membership. Their own membership might have been more female or African American, like the public sector unions, like AFSCME. And Reuther, even though there were a lot of, you know, white guys in the auto workers, there were also a lot of African American guys in the auto workers. And Reuther sort of, you know, caught that, and he always thought this. He thought this in the 40s when he became president of the UAW. You know, he thought that the UAW should be, broadly speaking, an organization that defends sort of social justice. So there was a conflict between a few of the unions, on one hand, who supported these emergent social movements of the 60s and early 70s, and others, like some of the building trades unions, you know, parts of, like, the overall umbrella group, the AFL-CIO, George Meany, you know, famously said something like, you know, the anti-war demonstrators, like, you know, meaning the male anti-war demonstrators, you know, look these are jacks who look like Jills and smell like Johns,
right,
was Meany's remark in, like, you know, 1969 or 70. So there was a split, but there was also, like, a pushback against that split within labor, and that, you know, that should be recognized and understood as well.
Assuming that we see this implemented in Michigan, the implications are going to be, I mean, there's a, obviously, aside from just the implications in Michigan, I want to talk just a little bit about where you see the unions going in the future. But before we get there, what are the, you know, you quoted Iglesias, Matt Iglesias, in your piece about the sort of the truce, more or less, between right-to-work states, so-called right-to-work states, and states that allowed, essentially, unions to have some measure of parity in entering a contract with management. Is that where, what happens now politically? I mean, we saw some Michigan, members of the House delegation meeting with Snyder, saying, like, don't do this. This is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But where is there really anywhere to go now? I mean, because it seems to me that, and I think that, well, this is a big point of your piece, that if it can happen in Michigan, it's very difficult for it to happen anywhere. And maybe we need to talk before we get there about the referendum that lost this past November 6th, because the union smelt this coming down the pike, saw this coming down the pike. It's
right.
My mixed metaphor, I guess.
No, that's right. I think that the Michigan situation may be a case of, I mean, it's a cliche, but nevertheless, maybe a case of both sides overreaching. First the unions, and now the corporate leadership in Michigan and their political and ideological allies. Michigan is not Indiana. It should be noted that Indiana actually changed its right to work laws at the beginning of the year 2012. But the union density in Indiana is, you know, maybe half, slightly more than half what it is in Michigan. It, frankly, was just easier to roll the unions there. That was the first new right-to-work state and you know, quite a while, I think. I mean, that sort of began to, like, sort of chip away at the, you know, this kind of status quo where there were right-to-work states and there were non-right-to-work states.
And we should now say that Michigan would be the 24th state, I think, in the country.
Right, right. The country is roughly split, at least state-wise. I think population-wise, there are still many more people in non-right-to-work states. However, it's the old Confederate South and the sort of, you know, fairly lesser populated sort of mountain states and plain states of the Midwest that are right-to-work. So Michigan unions saw what happened in Indiana. They were looking at Wisconsin and the fight in Ohio, and they said, well, let's get ahead of this and run a referendum, which would enshrine collective bargaining in the Michigan State Constitution. And, you know, sort of on the surface, that sounds like an appealing idea if you're a labor strategist in Michigan and maybe around the country. But you have to remember, like, when the UAW was at its peak and Michigan probably had, like, 40% or union density, like, 50 years ago, when Democratic presidents used to begin their Democratic candidates for president used to begin their campaigns by campaigning in Cadillac Square in Detroit with thousands of UAW members cheering for them. They didn't have to do the Constitution thing because it was a fact on the ground that the unions were powerful. So they try to do this thing, but the paradox is that the very fact that they had to do it demonstrated that they were too weak to pull it off. So the referendum, they run a full campaign, $21 million. They're outspent by a little bit, like $25 million for the corporate side, but not too much. And they lose 58-42. Like in a presidential year when you're going to get a big Democratic turnout. So they run 12 points behind Barack Obama for this enshrining collective bargaining in the Constitution referendum. So that's when the right to work side says, you know, hey, that's an easy head count for us. I mean, they're not as powerful as they maybe wanted to think they were. Now we can beat them, so let's beat them. On the other hand, to change the status quo and make a state as identified with collective bargaining and union rights as Michigan, a right-to-work state, even at a point when unions are much weaker than they used to be, is a dramatic switch. And, you know, mostly, you know, Americans are usually, you know, unless things are very dramatic, frightened about change. Like even the big three auto companies don't want this to change. I mean, they have a working relationship with the UAW now. I mean, it's been bad for union members. I mean, they've lost a lot of wages and benefits, but the companies have survived, and they don't want to sort of shake this up. It's not in their benefit. Change they don't think is in their benefit, and I suspect a lot of Michigan voters don't want to shake things up either. You know, like they don't want massive demonstrations. They don't want somebody trying to figure out a way how to recall the Governor Snyder in that state. You know, they basically don't want, I would suspect, the trauma of a reasonable amount of civic unrest. So I think, you know, I'm sort of, you know, moderately optimistic that one way or another, this doesn't happen long term. Either Snyder backs down, which I don't know if he'll do that. He has a lot of people pushing him to do it. Or if he does sign it, there is some kind of referendum. Apparently, there's like something in the state constitution that does allow a referendum, although it's a tricky thing. It's kind of like a cue ball off the eight ball into the four ball into the side pocket kind of thing. But they might be able to do that, or else, you know, it's only 2 years to the next gubernatorial election. They will, you know, Dems will run very hard to replace Snyder and to replace different state legislators who voted for this. So I think they might be able to turn it around in Michigan. You know, so, beyond that, the fate of the broader American labor movement, that's more problematic.
Well, let's talk about that briefly, because you mentioned that in Nevada, I think it's the Culinary Union.
Right, Culinary Local Union 226.
They're working in the context of a so-called right-to-work state, and they have had a tremendous amount of success because of the nature of the union. And I want you to just sort of outline that. And also, one of the things that struck me this past year, we had the Chicago teacher strike, which was incredibly effective. And one of the things that the teachers were able to do, and I presume part of it is because they're teachers, but they had the ability to communicate, and they spent resources and time, and it sounds like they had a specific strategy long before they went on strike to create relationships with the broader community so that the broader community – now, of course, your teachers, you're talking to parents. It's almost sort of a – that's almost pre-existing in some respects, but they invested the broader community. they both weren't the teachers union was not just working for the teachers. They made it clear to the broader community that the teachers union was also working for the broader community, and that there are many people who argued in the wake of the failure to recall Scott Walker that what the unions might have been better off doing is making it clear to the broader community that, look, this is not just an attack on us. It's ultimately an attack on the broader community, because this is going to affect the services that you get. It's going to affect your wages. You need to invest people outside of the union in the union struggle.
Right, right. That's right. And, you know, I agree with you that the teachers in Chicago were quite effective, and that in general sort of that possibility opens up for members of what you might call like sort of caring professions.
Right.
Like teachers, like nurses, like, you know, like cops and firefighters, who, it should be noted, are excluded from this right to work law in Michigan because they often support Republicans, and it seems like that's a cutout designed to, you know, support groups that support right to work type people. And I do agree that, you know, it's very important these days for unions to be, as Reuther wished and hoped, to be as community-minded, as broad in their social appeal as possible. To not be what they're often called by conservatives and Republicans, special interest, quote unquote. To be organizations that advance the general interest. In Culinary 226 in Las Vegas is a fascinating story, because essentially you had a situation where you had a bunch of Las Vegas unions, a bunch of Las Vegas casinos, where you had unions that were somewhat corrupt, somewhat, you know, just going along with the corporations who ran those casinos. And the individuals who ran those casinos. And then you had a tremendous effort by the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, the parent of Culinary, to organize the entire town. And now almost every casino in that city, and it's the fastest growing city in the United States, even allowing for how badly it was hit by the recession, is unionized, except for Sheldon Adelson's and one other. And those housekeepers there, they in Las Vegas, you know, I mean, everybody got hit hard by the recession, by the housing bubble being exploded. But basically, they can live a middle-class life there. And the union is incredibly militant, has a tremendous esprit de corps. If you go to Vegas sometimes, you'll see workers in the casinos, just as they say in the labor movement, buttoned up, wearing like a Culinary 226 button, just to show they support the union. I mean, there is not a big problem getting union dues from workers at Culinary 226. It's one of the most powerful institutions in the state. He moved on to be president of the parent union. Leader of the union, D. Taylor, was like in a Nevada magazine or something 8 or 10 years ago, rated the third most powerful person in the state. I mean, that union has juice, and it has juice in a right-to-work state, because the workers feel that they own the union, the union empowers them, and they are happy to support that union with their union dues, because they know that union in turn has their back. So it's a fascinating story. It's a story that has a lot to do with how you know, the difficulties, but also the successes of building social movements. It's a big deal, that union in that state, but, you know, how do you sort of go from a state of, you know, 1 million or 2 million people to a country of 310 million and create that kind of energy for social change and within the labor movement? You know, obviously it's a much more challenging, complicated question to consider.
Yeah, I was going to, I mean, maybe it's an unfair question, but I mean, do you think that it's possible that we're going to see an evolution of unions to become, I mean, in some ways to, you know, it's one of those sort of, it's almost sort of the same dynamic of an insurance risk pool in a death spiral in some respects, that you're maintaining the last vestige of your power, which is keeping you alive to a certain extent. I mean, I think you even may have said in your piece, or I just read, they're taking a certain medicine which is keeping them alive, but it's also making them weaker in some respects.
That's the trick with automatic union dues. It's actually a vexed question. On one hand, this makes the functioning of a union, the receiving of its revenue base, from the workers, because that's how unions obtain their money from union dues, the way a government obtains money from taxes. And that's how it funds itself. It makes it easy because it's automatically deducted from workers' paychecks under the auspices, actually, of the employer. The trick is, and you use the term insurance, that is exactly the cusp of the issue. Is a union and essentially an insurance company where, right, you send in a check or you have it automatically deducted from your bank account every month or every 3 months or yearly, and the insurance company provides you with a service, especially when particularly when you need it most badly. You know, you get money from the insurance company in turn when things aren't going well for you, your car gets totaled or whatever. So is the union that, or is the union actually a social movement, an institution that advances social justice, as Ruther wished, and as Dr. King said too? You know, wise to remember, Dr. King died was shot in the middle of a union struggle of garbage workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He went there to support that. That's the trick. If it's an insurance company, then actually the easiest thing to do is to take the money out. And in fact, most unions need that today. Most unions aren't Culinary 226 in Las Vegas. The relationship between them and their workers is sometimes good, sometimes bad, something in between, but they don't have like the sort of wherewithal, the logistical power to sort of go to each worker and sort of say, hey, you know, the union is a good thing. You need to really chip in yourself to keep it going. Otherwise, it's going to fade away. You know, we can't keep providing you services without you giving us something. So is it an insurance company or is it a social justice movement? If it's a social justice movement, you see, as in Culinary 226, people gladly give the money. I mean, they're receiving benefits, yes, but they're receiving benefits because they feel that the union empowers them and they in turn by the backbone of the union. It's a complicated issue.
Yes, and I appreciate your talking to us about it. And it's just been reported that the House, Michigan House, passed the legislation 58-51, and now I guess it heads to Governor Snyder's desk, and we shall see. But Rich, I really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sam.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye bye.
That was the signal that our time is up with the guest. Oh, okay. No, that was apparently an ad that kicks in on that page. All right, folks. Oh, I went a little long. Tomorrow on the program, Becky Bond from Credo will be with us to talk about Credo Mobile as a service and what they do to support the left in this country and movements, and also. Of course, it's a good phone service. Also on the program tomorrow, Ken Burns to talk about his new movie that he, I believe, he co-directed with his daughter, I think, and her husband on the Central Park Five. You remember this story from, was it the late 80s? I'm not quite sure when it was. The story of the stockbroker, she was jogging through Central Park and was supposedly raped and attacked by, or I should say she was raped and attacked supposedly by a gang of wilding teenage African-Americans. And the real story, years later, is has obviously came out, and a couple of these teenagers, several of these teenagers, basically spent years in prison for a crime they did not commit. And then I guess it was back in 89 or so. We're going to take a break. I Am Machine is on. You can call me at 646-257-3920. Folks, if you've not become a member of the Majority Report, please do. It's your support that still provides 98.5% of our revenue. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support the show by following our link, credomobile.com/majority, where you can check out Credo. We'll have more links for you and more information on that after tomorrow. But check it out. Great mobile service. We'll give you details on it, in the coming days. They're also a great organization, both in terms of supporting other organizations on the left and really letting our representatives, particularly in the House, know where we stand. They've been very big on this fight to keep Medicare from being privatized in the guise of raising your eligibility age. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. In the better half of the program, Nicholas Kristof, oh, he just needs to tell those poor people how to run their lives. And the idea, women having babies. This guy, what a troll. What a moral scold. Also on the program, the war on Christmas continues to rage on. I know you're not, maybe you're not aware of it. Maybe you just, that's part of the problem in this country. You secular leftists just allow for the other secular leftists to fight your battle on the war in the war on Christmas as it rages on. You're not even aware of it. Just go through your day. Now you're not even aware. There's a war going on against Christmas. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. 646-257-3920 is the number. The IM is Majority FM or any of our legacy ones. Majority FM at jabber.org. Back in a minute.